Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to school to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
You know how healthcare pricing can drive you absolutely crazy? Well, as of today, it might still do that, but at least you'll know why. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Wake up to the day's top business headlines. Subscribe to the Marketplace Morning Report podcast. It's on iTunes and marketplace.org/podcasts.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. This is the Marketplace podcast for Wednesday, the 8th of May. Glad to have you with us. And I think we can all agree that healthcare pricing in this country has become almost a parody of itself, right? How at one hospital you pay this much for an appendectomy, and down the road at another, you'll pay twice as much or half as much. I don't know. And the numbers just show up on your bill or on that statement of benefits you get from your insurance company. No rhyme, no apparent reason, no nothing. It is that lack of clarity, shall we say, that goes a long way to explaining why the federal government did what it did today. It released a database that shows how much every hospital in this country charges for the 100 most common procedures. And it could, if it works right, affect those prices that make us so crazy. From the Marketplace Health Desk at WHYY, Dan Gorenstein reports.
CEO Jim Weinstein woke up this morning at the usual time.
About 4.
When he found out prices at his hospital system, Dartmouth-Hitchcock in New Hampshire, were being publicized, a smile spread across his face.
I was kind of happy to see that finally we're getting some transparency.
Weinstein says it's a shame patients often know more about their breakfast cereal than the cost of their health care. But he says not all hospital executives feel the same.
This is threatening to people to have data out that maybe shows the difference in charges and payments. And having that public, I think, will force change.
That's exactly what federal health officials want to hear. The Centers for Medicare and Medicaid released what until now has been sensitive proprietary information. The average price at every hospital for everything from treating pneumonia to implanting a pacemaker. What's troubling is how wildly different charges can be from one hospital to the next for the exact same service. The head of Medicare, Jonathan Blum, believes arming consumers with this data will put pressure on hospitals to standardize prices.
Really, our goal is to ask questions and a much more public conversation why there is so much variation.
Now, this data, which totals more than 17,000 pages if you print it out, tells only part of the story. It doesn't tell you what most people actually pay. Health insurers negotiate big discounts off these prices. It also doesn't tell you anything about whether the money you spent on your heart surgery was good value. But Bob Kocher, a former Obama health advisor, says it's still essential.
It's the first time we now have some price point at which we can begin to have the market evaluate hospitals and then move market share.
Will airing all this information force hospitals to change their prices? Health people I spoke to say no. Does it shift the conversation, putting more attention on hospital pricing? Yes. I'm Dan Gorenstein for Marketplace.
Syria is once again connected to the internet. It disappeared from the World Wide Web yesterday afternoon, was gone for about 19 hours, in case you didn't notice. Matthew Prince is the CEO of Cloudflare. That's a company that's in the business of keeping other companies online. Matthew, it's good to have you with us.
Thanks for having me on.
First things first, I suppose, how does one go about turning off the internet for an entire country?
Well, certain countries have limited access to the internet. In the case of Syria, there are actually only 4 connection points, and they're all run by the National Syrian Telecommunications Company. And so what effectively happened yesterday around 2:48 p.m. Eastern Time was all of those connections were turned off with literally this stroke of a command on a computer so that no packets could get in or out of the country.
Packets, you mean little information packets, right? I mean little things moving through the internet.
That's right. So whether it was an email or a phone call over a voice over IP system or a tweet, what happened was those routers stopped announcing how to get information in or out of the country.
So this is going to sound like a really basic question, but how do you know? I mean, I'm imagining a company like yours and you know, the American government somehow has a room in which the internet is a bunch of lines on a map. Do you see it go dark?
Yeah, we literally watch the routes get withdrawn from the country of Syria. So Syria relies on a number of upstream providers that connect them to the rest of the internet. And each of those providers had those routes just stop. So we watched that. And then at the same time, we also saw requests to our own network stop from Syrian users that were trying to access sites that were behind Cloudflare.
Yeah, here's the thing I don't understand about Syria, though, and frankly about a lot of this. I mean, the whole thing about the internet is that it's dispersed and decentralized, and you can find a zillion different paths to get anywhere you want, right? I mean, if I ping a certain website, it doesn't go the same way every time. Is it because there are only these four points of connectivity with Syria that Bashar al-Assad could flip a switch, in essence?
Well, we don't know exactly who flipped the switch, and so I.
Well, it's a safe bet that it was Bashar al-Assad, right, or somebody working for him.
Somebody that controlled those internet routers, and the fact that there is a state-controlled telecommunications authority means that it's likely that it was someone associated with the government. But it is absolutely that case. This is something that is possible in Syria, but in most of in the United States and most of Western Europe, this would be impossible just because there are so many connection points, there are so many different routes in and out of the internet that it literally would be impossible to do what happened in Syria.
Matthew Prince, he's the CEO and co-founder of a company called Cloudflare. They do website security and things like that. Matthew, thanks a bunch.
Thank you for having me.
Well, looky there. More up arrows on Wall Street today. Details, numbers, the happy music when we get there. JP Morgan Chase CEO Jamie Dimon is doing his best to keep both of his jobs. There's a move afoot among some big shareholders in the bank to not let him be chairman of the board anymore. Mr. Dimon did survive the same threat last year, but he's been through quite a few scandals since then. And right now, what he needs is some political capital, shareholder votes in JP Morgan's annual meeting, coming up in a week or two to be precise. Dimon's going to have to do a lot of politicking to get him, as Marketplace's Mark Garrison reports.
Think about Kevin Spacey's character in House of Cards. As the menacing majority whip, it's his job to know how members will vote and put them in line.
Don't surprise me.
Rich Galen was a top aide to a real Speaker of the House, Newt Gingrich, so he knows plenty about managing close votes. First, you count up the votes you've definitely got and the ones you just can't convince.
And if it's still too close to call, then you literally rank the people on the fence in order of how badly you're going to need their vote.
So let's start with the votes Dimon won't win, like those of some large public pension funds. Lisa Lindsley of the government workers union AFSCME brought up the non-binding proposal last year. It got 40% of the vote.
There's an inherent structural conflict of interest when a CEO is the chairman of the board.
Then there are proxy firms which advise shareholders on how to vote. They're influential because many shareholders don't have time to look at every proposal. One of the biggest proxy firms is Glass Lewis, which generally opposes CEOs as chairman. Chief Policy Officer Robert McCormick says this year's vote on Dimon could be tighter.
It's likely that shareholders who may not have supported this in prior years may be more inclined to support it this year, given the troubles with the London Whale.
On the other hand, Warren Buffett backs Dimon strongly. Big money management firms like Fidelity and Vanguard are reportedly undecided, so Dimon's focus is on their votes. The political comparison only goes so far. In business, there are too many votes for even a master whip to get in line for sure. In New York, I'm Mark Garrison for Marketplace.
Take Vince Lombardi, Phil Jackson, and who, Joe Torre maybe from his Yankee years, and roll them all up into one, and you get some idea of what Alex Ferguson means to English football, the kind you play with your actual feet, by the way. Ferguson has been the manager of the British Premier League's Manchester United since 1986. He has wrapped up 38 championships of one sort or another along the way, and he's retiring. Fergie announced today he will be stepping down at the end of this season. Even non-soccer fans have heard of Man U, as it's known. What you may not know, though, is that that football team is a publicly traded company worth more than $3 billion. Marketplace's Amy Scott has more now on what Ferguson's departure means for one of the world's top sporting franchises.
Sir Alex Ferguson took an already legendary team and turned it into a global powerhouse.
United is simply a commercial phenomenon.
Kevin Roberts is editorial director at Sport Business International, a publishing and marketing company in London. Not only does the club regularly sell out the largest stadium in England, it rakes in billions of dollars in broadcast rights and sponsorships internationally. Roberts says Man U has teamed up with banks and mobile companies eager to associate with its brand from Sweden to Vietnam.
They have found new ways of raising revenue, of developing international markets. But none of that counts for anything if the team isn't winning on the field.
And win they have, with 13 Premier League titles among many victories. When the company debuted on the New York Stock Exchange last year, the prospectus warned investors not to expect the same results under different management. Rory Miller teaches in the football industry MBA program at Liverpool University. He says the coach clearly matters, but
it's the collection of players and the results that they get on the pitch that is more important than the coach.
And Man United has proven before that its brand is stronger than one man. After legendary coach Matt Busby quit in 1969, several successors failed to recapture the glory. At one point, the club was relegated to Division II. But United came back and now dominates the Premier League. I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
Time was, well, just a couple of years ago, actually, that relations between the president of France and the German chancellor were so close they had a special nickname. Anybody remember Merkozy, Angela Merkel and Nicolas Sarkozy? Sarkozy left office a year ago, though, and ever since François Hollande took over, a distinct chill has befallen Europe's most important relationship. From the European desk, Marketplace's Stephen Beard reports.
Think of the Franco-German relationship as a bicycle made for two.
Je m'en allais chercher des oies, du côté de fouiller les oies, la bicyclette.
Given their long love affair with cycling, the French once relished the metaphor, two countries on a tandem, driving the European Union. But lately there's been a problem.
The question of the tandem is, who is steering?
German analyst Heinz Schulte says the French won't take the back seat, but they should.
Either the French return to the Franco-German tandem, with the Germans now in the driving seat, or France will no longer be a major player.
He says the Germans are fed up with the French for not pulling their weight in the tandem. French analyst Dominique Moisy says the Germans have a point.
Germany feels that France doesn't do what should be done in terms of pedaling.
France has not delivered what its fellow cyclist feels is necessary, budget cuts and radical labour market reforms. Instead of raising the age of retirement like the Germans, the French have lowered it. But that, says Laura Slimani of the ruling French Socialist Party, was what François Hollande was elected to do, to fight austerity in Europe.
The policy that's being pushed by Angela Merkel and conservatives in Europe leads to more unemployment, more debt, and to people getting poorer and poorer, especially in southern countries.
A draft document from the French Socialist Party accused the German leader of selfish intransigence. The document was later withdrawn, but Laura Slimani agrees with that wording.
Maybe the words were strong, but I would say they were actually showing a reality.
But Merkel has been lightening up. France and Spain have just been given two more years to get their budget deficits down to 3%. And Constanze Stelzenmüller of the German Marshall Fund for the US in Berlin says Merkel hasn't only been pushing for austerity.
It's about structural reforms to national markets and in particular labour and services markets to enable growth.
She says President Hollande clearly faces strong opposition from the left wing of his party, which might explain the attacks on Merkel.
Blaming the Germans is a nice way of getting off the hook for being unable to perform these reforms.
Nevertheless, this is not some trivial spat, says Dominique Moisy, but a serious mechanical failure.
The tandem is working imperfectly, and the European machine does not progress.
And you
sweet upon the seat of a bicycle built for two.
Unless the EU's top two riders get back in the saddle soon, he says, Europe's economy will run out of road. At the European Desk in London, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
Coming up, hey, listen, where's that meeting going to be again?
They had conference rooms there named after things that are massive mess-ups in history. So one is named Subprime Mortgage.
Oh, there. Okay. But first, let's do the numbers. I don't know, you guys. The markets just keep on going up. The Dow Industrials rose 48 points today, a third of 1%, closed at 15,105. The NASDAQ climbed 16 points, a half percent, finished at 3413. The S&P 500 tacked on 6 points, 0.4%, 1632, the number you're looking for there. Whole Foods added a healthy 10% as earnings beat estimates. Video game company Electronic Arts more than stayed in the game, scoring 17% on optimistic forecasts for next fiscal year. Disney's results weren't quite as great and powerful as that, though investors edited out 0.1%. Real estate listing service Trulia discounted nearly 8% today on plans to acquire real estate software maker Market Leader. Bonds up, the yield on the 10-year T-note, down to 1.77%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Show Marketplace how much you like us. Stay connected to our hosts, reporters, and top stories on Facebook. Find us at facebook.com/APM Marketplace.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Thursday. In Washington, the House Homeland Security Committee holds a hearing on the Boston bombings. President Obama is scheduled to take a trip to Austin, Texas to talk about the economy. And show me the money. It's on display at the American Numismatic Association's National Money Show, getting underway in New Orleans. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdahl. As we've been telling you, the real estate market in much of the country is coming back. If you're trying to sell a three-bed, two-bath split level, that is. If you've got a big historic building you're looking to unload, say an old factory or a hotel, it's a whole different deal. Those things can sit on the market for years until a little social media word of mouth gets going for you. Gigi Duban has that story.
The Thomas Jefferson Hotel in downtown Birmingham has been on the market for 15 years. In the lobby were sidestepping broken glass and trash on the floor. But it's still kind of beautiful inside.
You'll see the gingerbread markings across the top. It's very intricate design work around the ceiling here in the lobby area. And these were made by German plasterers.
That's Chip Watts, president of Watts Realty, the company selling the building. It's listed at $1.5 million. To restore the hotel, add at least $20 million.
It's been difficult to sell simply because of the size. It's over 158,000 square feet, 20 stories tall with a basement.
But Watts started noticing more people drawn to the building on social media sites.
To one point, during the summer, we were getting anywhere from 5 to 10 requests a week for people to gain access.
Watts thought, hey, this could help. So his company started checking out the keys. People would go in, take pictures, and post them online. And just like that, instant buzz.
We've had interest from all types of groups. We've had interest from paranormal groups. We've had interest from social media groups that are interested in coming in, taking photographs of the property, amateur photographers, professional photographers. Everybody wants to get inside.
Watts' company even used some of the photos in ads for the building. In other parts of the country, scores of people are trying to get a peek inside historic and abandoned buildings. They post photos on sites like Instagram and tag them with hashtags like Urbex for urban exploration. And for some Instagram users, the more dilapidated the building, the better.
Some people call that ruin porn.
That's Lee Tussman, creative director of Hidden City Philadelphia, an online news outlet that focuses on vacant and historic spots around the city.
Which is the fact that photos of broken down, abandoned, or bombed out looking spaces are very attractive.
And then there's that whole forbidden fruit thing. Tussman's group partners with property owners to give what they call managed access. The idea is essentially, hey, you don't need to trespass. We'll let you in. As an added draw, Hidden City puts art installations inside some of these vacant buildings. The hope is it'll open some doors.
People might find a new use for a space that way, someone that might want to rent it, a developer that is interested in having some kind of partnership in the area.
Then there are people like Matthew Christopher, who started Abandoned America. It's a website featuring photos of abandoned sites across the country. Lately, he's been hosting photography workshops inside old factories and retired cruise ships.
I think if people have legitimate means to go in and experience a place, 9 out of 10 people are going to want to do it that way.
But realtor Chip Watts gave people access to the Thomas Jefferson Hotel for 3 years, and things still went horribly wrong. People broke into the place dozens of times, stealing stuff and vandalizing the hotel.
We even had people that got into the property at night and shot off fireworks off the roof, and we had a base jumper that jumped off the tower.
Watts cut off access, put up boards and fences. He got bigger locks. But in the end, things seemed to have worked out. The Thomas Jefferson Hotel is now under contract. In Birmingham, I'm Gigi Duban for Marketplace.
All right, what do the following things have in common? Characters played by Matt Damon, names of the members of Wu-Tang Clan, and signs of the Zodiac. I was going to pause right here to give you a chance to guess, but you're never going to get it, so I'll just give it to you. They are categories that companies are using to pick names for their conference rooms, which are, I'll tell you, way more creative than what we've got here. We've got the big conference room and the small conference room. Rupal Parikh at Ad Age wrote about the conference room naming phenomenon the other day. Rupal, welcome to the program.
Good to be here.
So give me a couple. Give me your favorites.
I thought it was funny that Facebook, it takes this very seriously.
Why am I not surprised?
Yeah, exactly. Knowing that they have a culture that is all about learning from your mistakes, I love that they had conference rooms that are named after things that are massive mess-ups in history. So one is named Subprime Mortgage.
Oh, man. I wonder what it says about us, Marketplace, right? That as I said up at the top, we've got two conference rooms here, and we call them the big one and the small one.
I think it says that you're a lot like advertising it. You know, we've got a green room because the walls are green. Maybe it means we're just not as fun, or maybe it just means we don't really have time for all of that.
Speak for yourself, man. We're a lot of fun. Is it possible, do you suppose, the companies go overboard on this one?
I think so. It's kind of out of control. If you look online, you'll find all of these threads that are basically people that seem like they are in a state of panic, begging for help with naming their conference rooms.
Wow.
There was a company that said, hey, we're setting up in Boston. What should we do? We need conference rooms that are set up for Boston. So, of course, people then start, you know, suggesting names named after Boston sports teams or named after stops on the subway. And,
yeah,
you know,
the historical theme and revolution and this and that. And, you know,
exactly.
You can go crazy. But here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to crowdsource this one. So here's what I want listeners to do. Write to us. Tweet at us. We're at Marketplace APM. You can get me at Kai Rizdahl and give us some names for our conference rooms, because big and small now, frankly, seem lame. That's all I can tell you. So we're going to fix that. All right. Rupal Parikh, she is the deputy managing editor at Ad Age. Thanks a bunch.
Thank you.
I meant that, by the way. Tweet us, Facebook us, leave a comment on our website. We'll go through them tonight, pick our favorites, and you get to vote on the winner. The legislative sausage-making known as marking up begins tomorrow for the immigration reform bill. The Senate Judiciary Committee is going to start debating changes and amendments to the 800-page draft of that bill. The big guns came out early, though. A report from the Heritage Foundation on Monday that said legalizing undocumented immigrants would cost programs like Social Security and Medicare $6.3 trillion over the next 50 years. Commentator Robert Reich says that's one way to look at it.
The argument over the budget costs of legalizing undocumented workers helped derail the last effort at immigration reform in 2007. And this time around, opponents of reform are trotting out the same boogeyman. But there's reason to think their claims are exaggerated. First, Congress is likely to exempt undocumented workers and their families from federal benefits while they seek citizenship. And that's a process expected to last at least 13 years. Meanwhile, they'd be expected to pay into Social Security and Medicare. On balance, they'd actually be a net plus for the federal budget, at least in the short term. Longer term, evidence suggests that workers who become legal are more productive and command higher wages. That's because they're free to pursue better employment opportunities, including starting their own businesses. After President Reagan gave legal status to 3 million workers in 1986, their wages increased by as much as 15%. Higher productivity and higher wages translated to more tax payments and less need for social services. We also have boatloads of evidence comparing new immigrants to native-born Americans in terms of what they contribute and what they cost society. And here, too, the results are encouraging. New immigrants are less likely than native-born to use government safety net programs. New immigrants also tend to work until an older age than native-born Americans, and that means less of a burden on Social Security and Medicare. The reason for these differences is that new immigrants are, by definition, ambitious. They wouldn't have borne all the risks and hardships of immigrating to the United States if they weren't. Giving undocumented workers a path to citizenship would not only be good for them, but also good for the rest of us. A final personal note. This is my last commentary for Marketplace after almost 25 years. It's been a true privilege talking to you.
I'll do the standard ID here. Back and outs, we call it, and then a word or two. Robert Reich is a professor of public policy at the University of California, Berkeley. He is, might I also add, a class act. Bob has been a voice on this program almost since the beginning in commentaries and special series and the occasional straight man in funny bits where we needed him. And he'll be on again, I'm sure. But the thing is, we're just not doing commentaries like we used to. You can get a hold of us about this or anything else you like at marketplace.org.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note today, anybody remember Jeff Skilling? Got to go back to the days of Enron and its aftermath. Skilling was the president. Ken Lay was the CEO back then, if that rings a bell. In 2006, Skilling was sentenced to 24 years in jail, but there is word today he's reached a deal with prosecutors to cut that time short. He'll waive further rights to appeal, disgorge $40 million to the victims of the Enron fraud, and be out as soon as 2017. All right, we're done. That is Marketplace from APM. Carlos Asensio, Ravi Carmen, Chris Clark, Stephen Colon, Bill Lance, Jeff Peters, Charlton Thorpe, and Brendan Willard engineered the broadcast for us. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We'll meet you back here tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.